This podcast with Michael Davies is a London Business School lecture on becoming digital explorers, led by Michael Davies, visiting lecturer of strategy and entrepreneurship at London Business School. You will learn about the impacts of digital and how executives and organisations can thrive in an ever-changing, disrupted world.
What I'm going to talk about is about the importance of becoming a digital explorer and some of the learnings from what is now 5 or 6 years of working with companies to become digital explorers. And oddly enough, as part of this, I need to explain what a digital explorer is. Now, in order to do that, I've got to set a bit of context about the way I have come to think about how digital technologies are affecting the world, which won't matter. And the so I'm going to begin with a sort of bit of context setting. And then I'm going to get into how businesses are responding. And then I'm going to talk about the why this is a great big problem and what you should go do about it. So that's sort of the arc of what I want to cover. But I'm going to start. There will be a couple of straw polls. Here's the first straw poll. A digital immigrant is someone who, by the time they left high school, entering college, at that critical period in your life where you're actually forming a whole variety of use patterns, did not have the internet and a PC and a cell phone. Did not have. But nowadays, presumptively, uses a PC and the internet and probably has a cell phone. Does anybody here not have a cell phone? Didn't think that was terribly likely. We have no true analogs here. So if you, during the course of your career, had to go from working in the analog world to working in the digital world, you're a digital immigrant. Who here is a digital immigrant? Who is not a digital immigrant? Digital natives, you had PC and internet and the rest. Can the digital natives stand up? Please, this is very deliberate. You're different. You have fundamentally different ways of interacting with technology. Now I have the last thing to ask. Does anybody amongst the digital natives have a smartphone by the time that they were leaving high school, going to college? No? Anyone? No? No. You did? We have a smartphone native. They're even stranger. You know why they're sufficiently strange? They kill people. Let me just explain this to illustrate, you can sit down, the behavioral differences that arise. I work with, amongst other companies, I work with Swiss Re, who are a bunch of very, very serious Swiss people who worry a lot about risk. And we're observing the phenomenon of distracted driving and trying to come up with an understanding for why, in case you didn't know this, road accidents have seen, after having been going down secularly for the last 25 years, started going back up again in the US. It's people like him. But do you know why? It's not cell phone users, it's smartphone users. It's a particular generation. Did you have it by the time you were 16? Did you have a smartphone by the time you started learning to drive? Did you have a smartphone by the time you were learning to drive? It's very important whether or not you did. It turns out that when you look at smartphone natives, people who had that, they drive in the context of using a smartphone rather than using a smartphone in the context of driving. And that turns out to have huge impact on how distracted they are. Because for those natives, when you look at their behaviors, the primary activity is the smartphone and the secondary activity is driving. Driving is just something I do when I'm using my smartphone. Conversely, for everybody, including my daughters that are a little bit older, they learned to drive before they got a smartphone. The reason I'm going to come back to this is this question about, there's a phrase some of you in the previous session, we'll talk about born analog versus born digital. Oh, by the way, the digital immigrants, we are unique in history. We're the only people who will ever have started our careers, our lives, our adult lives in the analog world and ended it in the digital world. Oh, crap, actually ended it in the smartphone world, which is even scarier. Very rapid transition. And that's sort of the grounding for this. A lot of the discussion around digital technologies deals with them in isolation. But these five technologies, smartphones, the cloud, the Internet of Things, AI and autonomous collaborative robotics are actually complementary to each other. The innovation that has gone into making smartphones is actually provide a lot of the physical technology that does this, and these require cloud services. And if I'm going to do a lot of that, I need this to do this, and these actually runs on top of the clouds, and robotics is basically putting these two things together and making them go do stuff. they are having unprecedented economic, social, and political impact. First big thing, we suddenly connected the world. If you go back a decade, just over a decade, because the anniversary is in mid-July, in mid-July of 2008, the launch of the iPhone 3G marked the start of the smartphone era. And then at that point, at any given moment, only about 1% of the world's population had rich connectivity to digital information or to other people. Nowadays, it's about 80%. We've basically raised the value of the network of people connecting with each other and the world, according to Metcalfe's law, about 10,000-fold. Unless you think that this is a developed world phenomenon, it's not. It's just as much as the developing world. In fact, some of the places on the planet with the highest penetration of smartphones are places like Myanmar. Well over 90%. Higher smartphone penetration than the UK. So in that sense, at least, in terms of the information economy, we are a less developed economy than Myanmar. By 2020, we'll be at 88% or 90% of working age people. This match will match worldwide literacy. And it will have taken 12 years, and we're 580 years since the invention of the Gutenberg press. So actually, this thing is happening relatively rapidly. Cloud services have been around since AWS launched in 2007 with the Elastic Compute, but there was a dramatic inflection point at or about 2013, 2014, sort of pre-2014, we're bumping along at 3% a month. Now, 3% a month is a pretty damn good growth rate. Compounded, anybody want to do the math, 1.037 to the 12th is about 50% year on year. Around that period, basically, we stopped using cloud services in small and medium businesses just for the technical side, and we started to be able to use them to automate almost every aspect of the business, at which point it went to 5% a month, right? 1.05 to the 12 is actually extraordinarily rapid growth. This is more than doubling year on year, and it basically took off, as did the related spending. So you see this dramatic shift in what people are doing with cloud services. Businesses built on IoT, this came up in the previous one, reshaping consumer behavior. One of my favorite examples, because this was a technology business who got fed up trying to sell insurers on the technology and actually ended up becoming an insurer because there was no other way to get the technology out there and adopted, despite the fact that they could demonstrate that it made their drivers over 40% safer. So this is a huge social and economic gain. And I don't know, because it's actually young people who mostly kill first themselves and then other people, significant positive impact on road deaths, somewhat offset by distracted driving. AI over this period has developed extraordinarily rapidly, and we're all sort of familiar with it. The thing that I don't think is yet widely appreciated is, even if it's what's so-called weak AI, the nature of the routine and narrow task that it can take on is broadening and broadening and broadening. So sort of, I think the interesting state of the art is routine narrow AI that can detect your emotions better than most people can and portray emotions sufficiently realistically that it cues you at the level that you cannot help responding to it. And that means we're not talking just about back office and admin work and shifting pieces of paper. We're talking about fundamentally automating a whole variety of interactions. It turns out when you do this and you offer people the choice between a human being pretending to care and a robot which you know is a robot, people massively prefer a robot. Hi, my name is Kelly. I'm here to help you today. Yeah, you're not. You're bored. You really don't want to talk to me and you're reading from a script. No, sir, we can't help you with that. Sorry, this is me doing the real human being rather than my robot voice, but... So companies like Soul Machines, who are currently partnered with the Bank of Scotland and Mercedes-Benz and a variety of other people. Cogito. Cogito are fascinating. This is the way technologies evolve. Cogito were developed as a way of improving the way in which organizations responded to veterans in the US with PTSD calling the VA. Why do you care a great deal about figuring out about that? Well, because it's the US and pretty much all veterans in the US have guns. And the difference between somebody who's anxious and angry is a mass shooting. Now, it turns out that commercializing that in clinical trials, the rest takes a really long time. So in the meantime, they actually figured out that the really interesting application of it is in call centers, where it will automatically pass and detect and help people be just much better by doing it by looking at things like Frequent overlaps, sounds tense, and speaking quickly. It will automatically parse that and determine emotional state from voice alone. Affectiva and crowd emotion will do it by looking at your face. One of their big applications, this is like the technology race, is actually dealing with distracted driving, because it can see whether or not you're actually looking at the road or you're looking down at your phone, and it can detect whether or not you're falling asleep. As you, the micro movements that you start to do, you know, it can pick those up. Moreover, it has become pervasive. Not quite as pervasive here as the US. This astonishing thing happened. I was working with Vodafone through a program where we were teaching a bunch of the top managers, and the program ran over the period of about 7 months. And we called the presentation that will never be the same twice, because we had to keep updating the numbers. We ran a set of sessions before Black Friday. We ran a set of sessions early in the new year. Basically, nothing happened between Black Friday and Christmas, except last year, the proportion of US households that had a voice-based AI went up by over 25 percentage points in that period. It was going up by nearly a percentage point per day, which is quite a rapid rate of transformation. So now over 50% of US households and 90% of US consumer spending has a voice AI in the house. It's worth emphasizing, however, that AI does have some really profound limitations. This seems to be a lot of what my discussions with people are. You can fool machine learning into thinking that this is a gun. Because while it's really good at routine and narrow stuff, no modern machine can match the ingenuity of a three-year-old. I have a two-year-old and a five-year-old, and I know how ingenious they can be. And if you think about the distinction here, the simplest way of finding it is this representation in terms of the DIKW hierarchy, which is, hey, we're really good at data and information as computers. If you actually want knowledge and wisdom, did any of you go to Andrew Lickerman's session on judgment this morning? Right. Wisdom is the stuff that enables you to make judgment. Right. So you want to get up here, it's people. Stuff below this is computers and easily passable. Robots rapidly becoming autonomous and collaborative. And I spent the first decade of my career working with robots in big automated factories and material handling, and they're all coming out of the factories. But as they come out of the factories, they become soft and they get a hell of a lot smarter. We used to have to write explicit code, go to this position, do this thing. This is someone that this would have got me arrested back in the day, grabbing a robot, no cage, and programming it by pointing it at what you wanted to do. These little solar-powered robots, I think, are going to be amazingly transformational, because once you've paid for them one time, or you've paid a subscription to support them, they can just keep going on endlessly. So don't think of these as necessarily great big hulking things. I think most of what we're going to see in robots is an awful lot of anywhere where I've got solar power or parasitic power, I will have little, slow, very cheap robots pottering around in large numbers doing things very carefully and precisely. Parasitic power is a room like this, where you can basically, there's enough electromagnetic radiation in this room that even if I don't have solar light, a whole variety of things will work quite happily. I pick up the resonances off the ballasts in the lights. That's parasitic power. You can make low-power things work. So you can make a little low-powered crawling robot work just by sticking it on the ceiling, and it will get enough energy off the lights and or the fact that there are cables running around. So what it does is it will trot over periodically to find an electric cable and just sit there absorbing energy from the electric cable. Very low power. That's what parasitic power is. And autonomous vehicles. These technologies, and you may have heard this term being used, are a platform. And I mean a platform in both senses of the word. Platform is a word which, although I don't know if there's anybody else who's a Russian here, I'm told it's two different words in Russian. But in every other language I've come across, the word gets used in two senses in a business context. One, something that connects people together. Facebook, in that sense, is a platform. And also something that enables you to develop products. 90% of the time, it's the same word, platform in Finnish, the imaginative platformy. And this set of technologies put together are a general purpose technology. Have anybody who's an economics background here, economists? Did you do any work on what a general purpose technology is? Or is it? Oh, it's okay. Okay. A general purpose technology is something that has an impact that goes way beyond the sector in which it was developed. Railroads. Okay, we developed the railroad for shifting stuff, but it changed where people lived, and it led to the invention of the seaside, right? And holidays and vacations and things like that. And it's having this set of impacts. I'm going to identify four, and then there's sort of a fifth. The first one is it's empowering people. And even as a technologist, I'm much more interested in the economic impact of the technology rather than what the technologies are per se. So just, hey, one of the ways I find helpful to think about, there's a lot of digital stuff. If you're a technologist, you need to know about the digital stuff. But what's actually much more important is you need to know the three or four big ways in which it's having an economic impact. First, it is empowering consumers. That's sort of where my journey began, observing some very fast behavioral shifts by people carrying smartphones around. People making well-informed decisions through connection, access to wealth and information. Secondly, it's changing the world of work in a way which I think is best overall summarized as unleashing creativity. Thirdly, it is supporting the development of a whole variety of new business models or the widespread promulgation of business models that already existed, but they become much more prevalent because we're all connected together. And last, but by no means least, perhaps most importantly, because I'm going to hammer on this one till you're fed up of me saying it, it is accelerating the rate at which you can do innovation dramatically, really, really deeply and profoundly. It is also leading to this nasty phenomenon of digital dependence, which we will come on to. This is happening with unprecedented speed. From the printing press to the steam engine, 160 years. From the steam engine to the steel mill, 110 years. From electricity to the digital computer, 80 years. From the digital computer to the smartphone, 40 years. The smartphone to today, 10. There is no previous incidence of there being a major technological shift which happened, bloody hell, just to the point at which we got to the pinnacle of our careers and we were in charge of everything, they changed the rules. Really unfair and quite unprecedented. 6 years ago, I saw the fastest shift in consumer behavior I'd done ever. We were doing work for Samsung on their retail strategy in North America, and the proportion of people using a smartphone to look at reviews, check prices, and check availability in physical stores went from 7 or 8 percentage points of the population to over 90 in the course of 2 years. It is extraordinarily rare that you change the shopping behavior of 9 out of every 10 people in the course of just 2 years. And for those of you who didn't hear the last session, here's what happened next. Traffic in malls in the US, which had been going up in a secular fashion with an occasional dip for 2008, for the better part of 50 years, halved in 3. From 2013 to 2016, foot traffic in malls in the US halved overall. And actually, it was worse than that, because in the high-end malls, it went up, and in mid and low tier, it went down. You can't give away Class C retail real estate in the US anymore. And if you go looking, there is a great Wikipedia article, so rather than my putting up a big slide of this, called Retail Apocalypse, which describes the 17 more than billion dollar bankruptcies, the 38,000 closed stores, and the brutal margin compression that happened. We have a phrase in places that are richly connected called being yelped out of business. Being yelped out of business is the death spiral that happens if you get bad Yelp reviews, so people don't go, so your economics deteriorates, the quality of your food goes down, and your servers are unhappy because they're not making any tips, and you just go down the plug hole very quickly. And some of the things for me that are the most informative in your life are when you make a mistake and you get something wrong. I originally thought this would be restricted to clearly comparable big ticket items. Groceries. So I can draw a line straight from the advent of the smartphone to the impact on liquid food packaging. And it goes like this. It becomes easy to get reservations and use Uber to get to and from, so we eat out more, which is helping with food delivery because of people like Deliveroo, which is complementary to grocery delivery, and startups in the food industry have better word of mouth discovery, so there's less dependence on store shelf space and packaging, and you end up, if you are Tetra Pak, seeing your business being impacted because I make liquid food packaging and I'm suffering because of the invention of the smartphone. Almost no sector of the economy untouched. Retail, mobility, ride hailing for business, 2014 to 2017. 8% to 60%. Another astonishingly rapid 3 years, complete reshaping of business travel. Food, Deliveroo, they've slowed down a little bit, but they're still growing at tens of percentage points per month. And businesses traditionally thought of it. Airbnb, Carrot, we've talked about, Lemonade, simplifying insurance with chatbots locally, GP at hand, people like Dexcom. The fact we've networked people together is helping to drive the growth of peer-to-peer markets and the sharing economy. So as they become increasingly connected, there's all sorts of things I can do in terms of peer-to-peer marketplaces and sharing and on-demand. And this is happening with such astonishing rapidity that I find it breathtaking. It's happening way inside the planning cycles of all sorts of institutions. I live in Boston, and me and a subgroup of people are in a desperate fight over the planning strategy of the MBTA there, who refuse to acknowledge that ride sharing may be having an impact on the grounds they have no stationary statistics about how big it is, which oddly enough is a little bit frustrating because it's actually the biggest shift that we see happening in what's going on. It includes very different arrangements for when and where people work, using this platform to connect people with new ways. It turns out that this is one of the most contentious issues. And so I got really curious about it, about is this a good thing or a bad thing? And there are particularly pernicious forms of it. The UK form of the zero-hour contract is, in my view, pernicious because of the fact it restricts you from doing other things. But if you actually ask most people who are in the gig economy, it's actually about participating because it meets their current needs or goals. Most Uber drivers say they do it because it gives them the flexibility. And disadvantages it maybe in some respects, that flexibility is a price that would work well for them. This is where I have to pay a debt to Charles Handy, an erstwhile professor here, who was my professor, who I see some nodding heads. When he was here, he talked about people having flexible portfolio careers and doing multiple things at once, and I told him he was completely wrong. In fact, I was the person who was completely wrong, because there's a whole bunch of people who actually are doing this and organizing their lives this way. And we are seeing an end to the Faustian pact of the Industrial Revolution, which went like this. I agree to turn up to do something I don't like to do in a place I don't want to go to from 9 till 5 every bloody day. And in return, you will give me nice things and somewhere to live, and my children will live longer. That was the bargain we struck. Well, we can give away you all have to go to the same place at the same time piece. Critically, this newborn digital way of working is just much more effective than traditional approaches. Relentless and ruthless automation of routine tasks. A couple of my grad students at MIT have done a bunch of work about how you go do this. Purpose, creativity, collaboration, and agility, flexible working arrangements, and support for employees to pursue lifelong learning. Traditional workplaces are less innovative, are less productive. This difference will be compounded as they lose the war for talent, and good people will go to the places that suit their working desires. So if you're not competing on this dimension, you're partway into the death spiral. And there is no other way to go. Born digital insurgent businesses thrive in this environment. So this is not just tech businesses, but it's any business enabled by the way in which it uses technology in any sector of the economy. Many of them go by the sort of the D2C moniker because they have direct access to consumers via smartphone, cloud access for modular services that support all their business processes and scale really easily, widespread use of AI and ML to automate the routine and narrow tasks, and very rapid typing and product development. That means you can start easy, fast, and cheap, evolve quickly, and critically, a bunch of them, and this came up in the last one, are starting to be able to demonstrate their ability to scale up very rapidly in ways that just did not used to be possible. You can start faster and cheaper, you can change direction more easily, and you can scale up. Now, working with some big incumbents, there is a move afoot in some of them to basically say, you know, my current IT platforms and the investment I have and the billions I spend on SAP and all sorts of other platforms, actually, they're an encumbrance. They're a disadvantage rather than an advantage. And I would be better off burning them down and rebuilding from scratch. A couple of multinational businesses who I know who are in the process of trying this, and their approach to doing running this experiment is literally, we will take a small Eastern European country where we operate, and we will turn off all the existing IT systems and all the existing products, and we will replace them with a radically simplified product portfolio on a radically simplified set of systems, And we're not even going to worry about the fact we've lost all the customer history and the data and the rest, because it was crap data anyway, and it had terrible quality, and we couldn't get hold of it. And we would spend more money trying to parse the historical data than we would just building a completely new system from scratch. Uber, for me, is interesting in all sorts of ways, but in particular, they're a case study of this rapid evolution. They're a founder. They go live in 2010, and for those who don't know, you should go look up their original pitch. We are Mercedes cars for very rich people in downtown San Francisco because the taxi sucks so badly. That was original ethos. Guaranteed that you would get a Mercedes limousine. Exploiting a gap in the market. They changed their name, because they were originally called Uber Cab, in October. It's only 2 years later they launch UberX. And UberX expands the pool. So this is the point they become a gig economy rather than on demand. And then they start ride sharing with Uber Pool in 2014. This is only two years later. This is a business. The interesting thing about Uber's success comes from not massive reserves of capital, but being able to make very significant shifts to the business, both scale up and change what you do every 2 years. Unfortunately, and I'm going to focus on just some of these, for those of you who are interested in these issues, please approach me and talk to them about them, because I'm actually in the process of writing a book about how we balance the possible benefits with the costs that goes with these. But in the context of today, I'm going to focus on one of these. What are the costs? Digital dependency. First, this has made us vulnerable to theft, hacking, misuse, widespread concerns about social isolation, manipulation by opaque algorithms or bad actors for their own economic and political aims. A lot of concern about that. Secondly, negative externalities, which is economists speak for, you would get an advantage from this, but I have to deal with your exhaust. Navigation shifting traffic to new routes, ride-sharing increasing traffic, hosting disrupting neighborhoods, and hosting may restrict the housing supply and increase prices in some cases. This is an economic negative externality. The host benefits, the guest benefits, the neighbor suffers. The person who's trying to rent, who doesn't already rent, suffers because rents go up. The tech titans' power, their lack of empathy and ethics. There's been an article in The Guardian every day for the last month about we should break up Facebook or something along those lines because of their power, which is, I think, heavily related to the fact that the tech community as a whole has been distinguished by a stunning lack of empathy and some pretty dubious ethics. But fourth and fifth, and these are probably the most important, a perfect storm of Schumpeterian creative destruction. Born digital businesses overcoming incumbents, economies of scale and scope, threatening widespread disruption, that has really profound implications for all stakeholders in incumbent businesses. And last, by no means least, because in the general populace, this is certainly the most prevalent concern, technological unemployment. Rapid advances in AI and autonomous robots enable most routine and narrow tasks to be automated. It's not a question of if, but when. We're already at the point when I talk about the robotics, I didn't put harvest automation up there, but it is now cheaper to run robots for field picking and market gardening in California than to pay illegal immigrants below minimum wage. And if you can reach that far into the economy, there isn't much left that's defensible. For established born analog enterprise, however, becoming digital is a difficult and hazardous journey. And as I was trying to parse what a lot of what was being written about digital transformation, I found it very helpful to sort of think of this as if it's a journey, it has some stages, right? I want to dig into each of these, but I'll give you sort of the overview of the landscape. The first stage is you become digitally efficient. And until recently, 90% of what you would read about digital transformation said, this is how I'll use digital technologies to do the exact same thing faster and cheaper. Yeah, it's faster, it's cheaper, but you don't change the business at all. Who here is familiar with RPA, robotic process automation? Anyone? Robotic process automation deals with the fundamental inadequacies of modern IT systems, which basically says, oh, we'd like to automate this, but actually getting into the core of this and dealing with the engine is so difficult that what we'll do is we'll have a computer which will pretend it's a human. Right? That's what RPA does. And you basically train it by watching what people do and having it interact with the screen as though it was a person. Right? And then you have lots of them doing this. That's what robotic process automation is. At stage two, you become digitally enabled. You're enhancing the current core business, and you're starting to grow revenue, but you're not yet creating new value. this is where it starts to become really valuable. And this is why this session is called Becoming a Digital Explorer. This is where you start to use the technologies to create new value. You go after new customers, you go after new products, you develop new business models, you actually do something genuinely novel. You're not just faster and cheaper, you're not just better to interact with, this is actually a new thing. And ultimately, that can lead to building platforms to support a digital ecosystem. Critically, this is where all born digital businesses start. They start with a presumption that they are efficient and so on. So let's dig into each of these. Most, way too many, digital established enterprises are only at stage one. What are we doing? We're not creating new value. We're applying big data and business analytics, faster and cheaper, but little, if any, change to core business processes. When I become digitally enhanced, I dramatically improve my customer dialogue, so they're more likely to stay with me. I do stuff that enables collective action by my employees. I evolve the way in which I bring people into contract, and I accelerate incremental innovation. So I start working with startups and scale-ups, but I'm not necessarily yet creating anything new. There's no breakthroughs here. The real value comes when you go beyond that to exploration. Now, this is not new as a way of thinking about the world. The intellectual foundations of this go back to Charles O'Reilly's and Michael Tushman's work on innovation and organizations and some work I did in the doctoral program at Harvard, where Michael Tushman has been studying why incumbent businesses fail over the arc of history, confronted with new technologies. And the statistics are terrifying. Somewhere, depending on the sector, every time there has been a rapid technological shift, somewhere between 8 in 10 and 9 in 10 of all incumbent businesses go bankrupt. You have between a 1 in 10 and a 2 in 10 chance of surviving through this transition. However, you can make some observations, which I'll go on to, about what are the characteristics of organizations that have survived through this transition. So a critical part of it is they actually become digital explorers. They start looking at how technology is changing behavior, what will they be enabling you to do, what are the key pain points. You're bringing to bear a really customer-driven perspective on products and technologies, not just incrementing on the features, and you have management ability to both sense and respond to changes in the environment. And this is a stepping stone on the way to becoming a fully digital business. There's a good piece about this by Michael Jacobides in a recent edition of LBSR, which talks about this. Building platforms that enable partners and drive the growth of a digital ecosystem. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about becoming a digital explorer, which is a critical waypoint, stepping stone on the way, and what we know about this. Well, the first thing we know is that different companies are at very different stages of maturity. So I've been out searching, trying to find incumbent businesses who appear, at least as far as we can tell so far, to be further down this process than anything else. And do we have anybody who's French here? The two best examples I have found are Schneider Electric, who are not really a French company anymore, I discovered, but are of French origins, and Accor Hotels. Schneider Electric are absolutely fascinating. And they picked this up early for a couple of reasons. They have a very, very globally diverse, externally focused leadership team. Every single member of Schneider Electric's top management team lives in a different city, which is not the city where of their nationality. Their head of strategy is Spanish and lives in Chicago. Their head of IT is French and lives in the building next but one to mine in Boston. Their head of marketing is English and lives in Japan. So they were extremely attuned to what was going in, and they bought a company which supplied conventional data centers, which got hosed, and they were very well connected to a bunch of people who were looking at how technology was changing the landscape. And the Accor Hotels one is even more interesting because what happened to them was their economics for a long while were very, very heavily dependent upon jacking up the prices of their luxury hotels in Paris in August to all of the tourists. And then one August, it all went pear-shaped. What happened? Airbnb. So they got hit more directly and harder than anyone else. They literally, all the French hoteliers got together and said, what's happening? Where are the tourists?
Have you been stealing my tourists? It being France, they all colluded, shared their prices, explained their utilization, agreed what they should be doing. Oh, no, we're all suffering from the same problem. So they call the mayor, and the mayor goes, I want to know where all the tourists are. Well, they're still coming in. This is how many came through Gare du Nord. This is how many came from Gare du West. This is what's coming through. Where are the tourists? They're coming to Paris. They're not in our hotels. Airbnb. And then shortly thereafter, the CEO of Airbus cancelled all of his hotel reservations for the Paris Air Show and rented one of those Grand Departements on the Champs-Élysées instead. Like, oh, wow. This really is a very difference. So notwithstanding the French reputation for innovation, the two best examples I've come across. So if you're becoming a digital explorer, there is both good news and there is bad news. I'm going to begin with the bad news. If you're a big incumbent, there's a perfect storm of creative destruction which is going to blow throughout the economy. I've sort of been searching for places it will not affect, and I know it reaches as far upstream as iron ore production. Somebody I was talking to earlier is in metals and commodity. I happen to have been doing some work with Metalloinvest, who are a Russian iron ore producer, and who see digital affecting their business in some pretty fundamental ways. Most established enterprises, unfortunately, remain vulnerable to this because a relatively small proportion are actually adapting. Few of them are yet exploring opportunities, and this is an outside context problem. I will explain what I mean by that for born analog leaders. And the reality is, if you go and talk to top management, it's not like they have abundant resources. The world, the conventional world, is competitive enough that you're going to face tough challenges in doing anything because of time, management time and attention, money. Back to that management time and attention thing. As this started to happen, Schneider Electric did something really interesting. Every single member of their top management team committed to spending an extra day a week looking outside the organization, not just talking to customers, suppliers, investors, employees, but actually really understanding what was going on in the world around them. Well, with some good news. In most cases, you do not yet have to do a big bet. There are a couple of exceptions. If you're in retail in North America, it's already too late. If you haven't moved significantly, you're part of the retail apocalypse. Your name is Sears or Toys R Us, and you've gone bankrupt or you're on the verge of going bankrupt. One of my friends runs the Prudential Center, which is one of the malls that's doing well in the US, and he had Lord & Taylor come to him, who've been a long-time tenant. They were the anchor for when it was first developed 30 or 40 years ago, and they said, hey, we're having a really tough time. Would you reduce our rent? And he went, ha, 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 no. But I will let you out of the early exit clause now on this price. And by the way, this is an exploding offer. You have till the end of the year to get out. Well, what are you going to do without us? Oh, trust me. I have so many better things to do in terms of creating a retail experience that I could do if I could get you out of there. Would you want to be out by the end of the year? Because you're going to be out within 18 months anyway, the way I look at it. But we've been around forever. Uh-huh, yeah, that would be your problem, not my problem. So, most cases. For most incumbents, some combination, this is the good news, some combination of no regrets moves, things you should do anyway, and smart decisions about what you're going to pursue in terms of real options is actually the right path to go. We have a pretty good sense of what leadership behaviors are required, what are the things we should, the ways we should be behaving, even if we're not necessarily always executing on them. And this is a waypoint towards building platforms and winning ecosystems. Let me drill into each of these, because this is sort of the real meat. Born digital companies are inherently digitally efficient. They're good at creating new value because they take it for granted. They can be incredibly efficient. They can have great customer interaction. They can go after new customers, products, services, create new value. And many of them are evolving into platforms and ecosystems. This threatens incumbents throughout the economy. I hope I've made the point by now that I can't find yet a sector of the economy unaffected by this. Oh, lest someone try something like luxury? Uh-uh, LVMH. Their new head of experience is ex-Apple, a guy called Ian Rogers. Right? Robots, milk, cars, insurance. This is one of the big malls in Chicago. Toys R Us, Sears. Unfortunately, most incumbents remain vulnerable. This is our best current estimate. It's not systematic in the sense of have we constructed an orthogonal sample set yet? No, but from the conversations we're having, I've tried it with a variety of people, more than still about a sixth or a fifth who are basically going, what, digital? Yeah, maybe, sometime soon.
The mode here is digitally efficient. If you look at the whole variety of survey data, it's consistent with this. About 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 significantly change the way they interact with customers. Fewer than 1 in 5, less than 20%, there's the English public school education for you, either becoming digital explorers, let alone building a digital ecosystem. And anyone here a science fiction fan? Who likes Ian M. Banks? Accession, an outside context problem. Here's what an outside context problem. An outside context problem is the sort of things that most civilizations encounter just once, which they tend to encounter rather than the same way a sentence encounters a full stop. And this is an outside context problem because of the speed and rapidity with which it happened. I went back, and a couple of days ago, as I was pulling this together, looked at when this started for each of these 5 relevant technologies. Now, Thomas Friedman in the US has written about this, about sorry for being late, and he puts most of it around the 2006-2008 timescale. Smartphones, 2008. The cloud, 06 to 14. The Internet of Things, the word was first used in 02. We hit 1-to-1 in 09. AI, the seminal paper is Hinton in 06. Speech recognition widespread in 10, image recognition in 12. The first DARPA-X study, which most people credit with being the biggest step forward in terms of what happened with autonomous robotic systems, is 2012. All of this happened within less than a decade. For most incumbents, the good news is there's a bunch of stuff you should do anyway, and most people don't have to do a great big bang, big bet problem. In fact, this is probably a mistake. You should only go do this if you are in one of those unfortunate sectors where it is happening with incredible rapidity, because the inherent risks and all the statistics about doing big bang transformation say they are extraordinarily prone to failure. So most of you should be operating in the let's figure out how we create some real options mode around this. And in order to do this, well, if you're going to create real options that are actually ever going to end up in the money and that you're going to pay off, you need to learn how to be ambidextrous. You need to figure out how you are simultaneously going to be doing incremental and sustaining stuff in your core business because you don't want to burn it down, and breakthrough and disruptive stuff at the same time. And this is probably the single most important characteristic of becoming a digital explorer. I figure out how to keep the lights on and the core business running and make it somewhat more resilient with a bunch of no regrets, cost-saving moves, you embrace digital in that business, but in essence, you're running it incrementally, and you otherwise starve it of resources. Because you know why? It is either going to die or shrink. And so you should be figuring out what it gets in terms of resources around a view of what will happen to that business as it gets assaulted by other people, and simultaneously figuring out how you actually go do breakthrough innovation. Now, there's a lot being written. This is from the Ambidextrous organization. Now, you say, well, how was Michael Tushman writing about this back in 2004? Well, because his research, where he's done more looking at this, is the what are the causes of failure and what are the characteristics, what are the leadership behaviors of organizations that have survived through this transition, this sort of transition confronted with other technologies. The scary thing is these transitions were, in most cases, much more slow. So this is a particularly rapid version of it, which means it will be more of a profound challenge. And it, most importantly, and this is why I'm going to sort of wrap up with and then conclude, it requires building a new set of digital leadership behaviors. Now, I'm an engineer by training. For my appointment here, I teach in strategy and entrepreneurship at this place that shall remain unnamed on the other side of the pond. I have a dual appointment in the leadership group at the Sloan School and in the engineering school on the systems thinking part. And I'm in the leadership side because the longer I have been involved with technology, the more focused I have become around the soft side of stuff, the leadership behaviors. And this view about what the leadership behaviors that are appropriate to digital leadership is an inductive view, not a deductive view. So I don't start with a general theory about leadership. I start with a set of observations about what are the common traits I have been observing behaviorally about the companies which are doing a good job. So in that sense, this is classical, grounded, Kathleen Eisenhart-style, case study-based view.
But this is the product of now, for me, over the last 3 or 4 years, literally hundreds of conversations and interviews with people about what are the characteristics of people who are doing this well versus badly, those who are succeeding, those who are failing. I've ended up, the current version has 9. This is the other slide that keeps changing as we think about it, of which I'm going to highlight 4. Because the other 5 are things that are quite common in other environments. They are important in this context. So things like having a sense of purpose becomes relatively more important. What we call embrace and flex, which is flexible organizations, becomes more important. The creativity and collaboration, that's been around as a behavior for a while, supported by the technologies. And accelerating learning and doing lifelong learning become really important. I'm not going to talk much about humility. I'm going to talk about one individual behavior and then 3 what I have come to call dynamic capabilities. And the way I found myself thinking about this is what do you do as an individual? How do you work together as an organization? And how do you make decisions about what you will do differently going forward? So first, ambidexterity. The ability to simultaneously evolve the existing core while also exploring new opportunities. We've touched on that one. Let's go to the other 3. Acuity. Even for native English speakers, not a very commonly used word. Why on earth did I pick a not very commonly used word? Because it perfectly describes what I was looking for. Sharpness or keenness of thought, vision, or hearing. And one of the key characteristics is getting outside the organization and being extremely attuned to weak patterns and things that are happening. How do you get to the top of one of those organizations? You work in every function, you work in every geography, you work in every product line. Right? You are a master of how to navigate that organization. You may not know very much about what is happening outside. I started finding the people who are doing a good job of this were much more attuned to what was happening outside the organization than what was happening inside the organization. That's a really big shift, and it brings with it all sorts of attendant risks. So my poster child for this is Schneider Electric, shifting 20% of all of their top management time to go out, get your hands on, understand what is really happening. Accor, making its top managers go stay in Airbnbs and one fine stays and apartments and do that for at least half of all their travel for a while. These are people traveling all over the world who are used to coming in as the general manager or the functional head of something or other. Oh my God, we have the general manager of France coming in. Put him in the presidential suite. No. He's coming in. What's he doing? He's staying in a one-bedroomed, shared-bedroom Airbnb down the street. Why? So he understands what the offer is like and what the experience is like. And this gives you insight about what's happening and, critically, foresight about what will happen next. Audacity. This is the most recent one to add. All of this is great. It's not enough to know that you need to be ambidextrous, and it's not enough to understand what's going on. You actually sometimes have to make a difficult decision. This is the most problematic one on which I find the jury out the most. Do you know why? Because there are relentless pressures if you're in the top management of a listed company about hitting the numbers and not risking the business. And they are extraordinarily inculcated by, amongst anything else, the human resources systems. This is really critical. Getting out of doing things incrementally and being prepared to take breakthroughs means that you will fail sometime. But the alternative is, if you don't accept some risk, you will fail anyway. And the thing I bring to bear for this is I've spent 20 years working with technology companies. And I teach and advise on how you make decisions like this. The thing about technology companies I've taken away from 20 years is they know this. It's in their lifeblood. If you have to replace your entire product portfolio every 2 to 3 years, you accept that failure is inherent risk of what you go do. So you accept that you must make audacious decisions because the one thing that guarantees you will fail as a technology company is not making a decision. The moment you postpone that, doing the same thing in the face of changing circumstances guarantees failure. So you may or may not succeed if you make audacious bets, but you know you will fail if you don't. So technology companies are really good at this. They're capable of making decisions, and I find it fascinating, the speed with which non-tech companies work. And lastly, and I put it at the end, because lots of people put it at the front, agility. Flat organizations. Now, there's a whole variety in terms of basic technology of a technology, I don't mean like a technology, like a tech technology, but a way of doing things that says that Agile is just a better way of doing things. And the more time I've spent doing this, the more convinced there's the ability to then move quickly and easily. Devolve authority, resolve issues rapidly, evolve quickly, empower small autonomous teams or tribes, and enable rapid innovation. I'm watching some organizations adopt this with astonishing speed. The other slide that kept changing in this education program was, at the beginning of it, we were fighting an uphill battle to enable some agile experiments. By the time we finished this program with top management, we had 10 times as many people converted over agile ways of working as we had originally had for our target in a year's time. Because it just rapidly became clear that in a whole variety of areas, that's a better way of doing things. I put the other stuff first, because otherwise what you end up with is what I call the headless chicken phenomenon. And the reason for putting agile last is you better know what the landscape looks like, and you better be making some clear bets about how you're deploying it, because otherwise all you're doing is going quicker in a whole variety of different directions or the wrong direction. The headless chicken phenomenon. So, questions?
So I buy the argument of agility, but how does that square within an organization that has compliance, governance, security, particularly around data? This is where Facebook is facing some trouble, that it adopted this model as well as some of the other previous narratives you've been through, but it kind of overlooked that moving from, I'm going to use the word prototype, into a hardened version of the software creates faults and flaws in its security, governance, etc. So how do you square the two there?
Let me give you an aside on Facebook. For those who weren't there in the last session, I spoke specifically to Facebook and where they said. I think Facebook's failures in this area are not a function of its being agile. They're a function of it not being clear about what it's trying to do and why, being deeply internally conflicted. So Google is completely clear about what it does, and all your data are ours and we will share them, but we do so in a way that ensures that I remain compliant even while I'm doing that. Facebook's been unable to actually make up its mind where it stands ethically. So their lack of clarity and purpose is Facebook's particular problem. Facebook has its own conundrum, and it's a mess. I mean, if you're going to put them in various things, Uber, fundamentally unethical, trying to be dragged in the right direction brutally by a new CEO. Airbnb, notwithstanding they impose a lot of externalities, has actually, you know, pulled out of cities on the grounds that it can't reconcile the way it wants to do things with the impact that it would otherwise have. So winding its net back in a big way. So a variety of places. How do you deal with this? There is nothing that says that you can't be a startup and actually, particularly given the way in which the fintech ecosystem is working, if you're dealing with things like compliance and so on, and still be compliant. So that, for instance, there are a variety of people doing things like KYC as a service, and given data integrity, you should be able to go do that. It happens that one of the funded ventures out of my last NTV classes is doing a wealth management portal for ethical Russians, tightly targeting. There are a lot of Russians live in London, many of whom are actually at least legitimate enough to be acceptable as investors and actors and so on in and fully compliant with Western regulations. And that's a startup. There's fewer than six of them. You build it into your modes and ways of practice from the get-go. Facebook's problem was they never really figured. Today, they still haven't figured out where they stand on a bunch of stuff. Zuckerberg does not have a clear moral compass, and neither does Sheryl. And if you have two leaders, neither of whom have a really clear moral compass around these issues, oddly enough, you end up with an organization that is morally confused. So go do it. In this country in particular, and there was a discussion earlier in the fintech panel about the importance of the regulatory posture, it's really bloody easy to do because the FCA's sandbox initiative is extraordinarily effective. So go enroll in that. The Swiss have an equivalent one. The Germans have one. It just takes you like 2 years to get signed up for it because we're Germany and we have this catch-22 about you need to prove you're a good person in standing before we'll let you come and be in the sandbox. Oh, by the way, there's a chart I do which was an analysis about, and if here in particular do it because the powers of the FCA to intervene are so bloody draconian. It's like I try explaining to the Americans, they can do that? So there's a chart which, there's a set of analysis I did, I was looking at 150-something startups and the reason for failure. Two-thirds of all the time is because you don't make something enough customers want all the time. And there's this little rump down here, which was like 3%.
And it turned out that when I went digging, and the 3% number is the reasons for failure, got sued out of existence. And they were all failure to comply with FCA regulations, which involved somebody from the City of London Police turning up and going, hi, see all the money you've got in your bank accounts that we can see, right? Put it all in escrow with your lawyers by 4 o'clock today and then give it all back to the investors tomorrow, to the customers tomorrow, and we'll have a conversation about not putting you in jail.
Going back to your ambidextrous point, what's your view on when the kind of digital initiatives have become so big that your organisation's, let's say, 50-50 or 70-30 if it's big enough, in terms of whether you continue in that fashion, because it's quite hard in reality to be ambidextrous, or whether you should split the company?
You probably split the company at that point. So there's a point at which you split the company or you split off large parts of the incumbent. Now, I'll use Acquia as an example. They're managing to grow some of their new digital platforms. Some of the other ones they've tried, and this is the audacity. They've tried. They had an initiative which is opening their core platform to third parties. Didn't work. Mostly things about the platform not being good enough. But part of theirs was a big part of what we used to do was own the properties, right? And they basically took the property side of the business, that asset-intensive, high capital intensity business, and sold it off. So that sort of restructuring may be a big part of what you want to do. You may well want to, for instance, go asset-light, specialize, and do things like that. So depends on your business. Does that answer your question? Yeah, as soon as it's clear that they're going in sharply different directions. Now, you're going, there's a whole variety of people who'd say, just wind down the core business. Well, very often you actually have assets that are of very high value because startups are really good at point solutions. They're really bad at platforms and broad solutions and scaling globally and things like that. They'll get there in the end, but this is where incumbents have an advantage. They can build on brand, reputation, relationships. There is stuff you can leverage across into it. You've just got to learn how to work in fundamentally different ways.
Your answer popped to thought about thinking of it a different way, which is the same problem upside down. So rather than you get to 30% digital and then you split the company, at what point should you consider floating off separately the new spin-ups so they can go and live a life of their own without being encumbered by the old organisation?
At which, in what economists would call the contracting issues between the two divisions, become sufficiently clear that you can actually do a clean split. So in the early days, the contracting relationship is likely the contracting. It's not literally contracts, but the contracting, the transaction costs associated with mediating interactions between the core and the breakthrough part of the business. The point where those are sufficiently stable and well-defined, you actually know how the two work together, then you can clear them off because then you can formalize them in an arm's-length contract. But that's not the characteristic often at a whole variety at the beginning stage because you're relying on the fact that I'm on a journey of discovery over here. Oh, and what I actually need is this over here, right? And if it was done in a formal contracted way, you wouldn't get it. You'd be held up in the negotiations amongst the peers. If any of you are struggling with these issues, curious about them, care about them, know of good examples of AI, I'm going to finish with two questions. I'm just interested. This is for me. Remember I talked about stages 1, 2, 3, 4? In the last organization you worked for or with, the last big incumbent, who was at level 4? Level 3, digital explorer. Level 2, fundamentally better customer interactions. Which business? Level 1, oh, holy crap. Level 0, oof, okay, so my stats aren't that wrong. Sorry. Here's the other one. Actually, I'm not even going to bother with that one. If there had been more at level 3 or level 4, we have a quadruple A rating. Quadruple A rating is demonstrated ambidextry, ambidexterity, demonstrated acuity, demonstrated audacity, and demonstrated agility, right? And so far, we've only got a couple of companies who get from us a quadruple A rating. Thank you.
This lecture is from LBS Live at London Business School. Find out more about LBS's short programmes at london.edu/executive education. And for more fresh ideas from LBS's experts, visit www.london.edu/LBSR.